in a class of scattering problems, and the class of scattering problem that I wish to consider now involves something. The example where I want the potential to vanish, strictly vanish, outside some region. And it could be some weird function of R inside of this region. And again, I want to consider scattering so that the incoming wave is of the form e to the ikz, and there will be some scattering of the form e to the ikr over r, f of theta, is a scattered wave, which will be described by a set of phase shifts delta. So what I want to do now is to describe a way of calculating delta L in some collection of problems. It can be done analytically for some simple cases, but it could be done numerically just as well for more complicated cases that you really wouldn't want to play around with the algebra for. What we know is asymptotically, as R goes to infinity, the wave function looks like the following expression. It's going to be the sum over all partial waves as R goes to infinity. So it's a sum from L equals 0 to infinity, sort of overall factor of 2L plus 1 over 2IKR. And then it's going to be e to the IKR, e to the 2i delta L minus, minus to the L, e to the minus ikr. So that's the asymptotic form of the wave function for arbitrary phase shift. Now, because v is going to be equal to 0 outside this region r is greater than a, then what you can do is you can calculate psi as a function of r everywhere for r greater than a. Because you know this is the correct form of the wave function, and you know that it's got to be written as linear combinations of L, J and N. So if you replace these you'll have a knowledge of what the wave function is everywhere. You can do that because you know the asymptotic form of J and L, N. And I guess that you spent some time doing that yesterday. So what you discover is that E to the IKR minus L pi over 2 divided by KR. Yes. Oh, yes. I don't know, for some reason I keep leaving that out. I have no idea why. This thing is, you want to think of this as being cos of the thing in brackets plus I sine of the thing in brackets. And then you know that one of these is n and one of these is j. And so the whole thing gives me a minus. So it's what you would have got by taking the limit r goes to infinity of minus nl of kr plus I times jl of kr. So if you took the limit as kr goes to infinity, you will end up with this expression. Whereas it's this expression almost, which shows up here, apart from some factors of minus to the L. So we can rearrange this thing, e to the ikr over kr, taking out a factor of minus I to the L, is what you get by looking at, so we want to put a factor of minus I to the L in this, minus minus I to the power L nL of kr, plus I times minus I to the L jL of kr. So that's what you need to put in here. And then similarly, for e to the minus ikr, to get this expression, you take the complex conjugate of that. So you change this to minus plus I to the L. NL is real for real KR, so that's all we have to do here is to leave that alone. And here you have a minus I to the L, JL of KR, JL is also real. So these asymptotic forms are what you get by taking the limit as R goes to infinity of these things. So that means you can now write down the wave function everywhere for R greater than A. And you will get psi of R is equal to now sum from L equals 0 to infinity, a factor of 2L plus 1, let's see, these KRs come out, so there will be a factor of 2I, and then you just substitute in this expression here, this expression here. So it's probably easiest to collect up terms proportional to JL and to NL separately. So there will be JL of KR, NL of KR, and a plus. And then there'll be some stuff here. So there'll be an e to the I, 2i delta L from this. And that gets multiplied by a plus I and a minus I to the L. Then there will be some NL term from this thing, e to the 2i delta L. We get a minus minus I to the L. So it's minus I to the L. Then we need to deal with this term here, which is I guess I'm going to have to erase this because there's some space. So it's minus minus to the L. E to the minus ikr gives me a minus I to the L. So I seem to get that, except it should have been plus I to the L. And that would appear to be it. Then from the N term, I'm going to get a minus minus to the L. And then there's another minus there and an I to the L. Times PL of cos theta. So this is an expression that we just want to tidy up because it's a mess.
Surely there's a whole equivalence class worth of functions that have the limiting, that have an asymptotic form like a wave function, we can't just go.
Well, you know that because you've got a PL here, each partial wave will decouple. So you know that for each partial wave, you are only allowed to have a J and an N. There's nothing else you can have for given partial wave L. So what else could you have? You know the set of functions is complete. So this has got to be unique. It's as simple as that. I mean, maybe it looks like magic, but it isn't really. It's just sort of going backwards from what we did before. So psi of r is equal to... Now, if I was clever, I would be able to figure out what all of these things were with no difficulty, but the obvious problem is that there's a factor of I missing here somewhere. Yes?
You write down that multiplied by the minus I right next to it. So e to the 2i delta L minus I
Okay.
Right underneath.
Here?
Yes.
No. Everything's multiplied by that.
Yeah.
But there must be a missing I here, which somehow I've managed to leave out. Let me just check what it did. No, it's not that I left one out, I've grown one, according to this. According to my notes, there's no I here. Does anyone want to disagree? Then it agrees completely. So let's look at this expression. Sum from L equals 0 to infinity, 2L plus 1 we're stuck with. J L of K R. Now let's see what we get. We get an E, an I, which is going to cancel that I. Let's leave it like that. So we get a minus I to the L, and that's a minus I to the L. And then there's an I and an I. So you end up with minus I to the power L. Common factor times an I into e to the 2i delta plus 1. Then the coefficient of nL of kr is equal to, see if we get that one right. So there's a minus I to the L, a common factor, and then there's a minus there and a plus there. So we have a minus I to the L, and we are going to get a minus e to the 2i delta L plus 1. So you get that thing which looks like a mess. This really must be some psychological block I've got. I really don't understand that. The way to make this look nice is to take out a factor of e to the I delta L everywhere and write it in the following form. Let's take out a factor of I as well. So we get, and a minus I to the L. Factors. So are you going to get J L of K R into E to the I delta L plus E to the minus I delta L from there. And then from here I'm going to get minus I. That's this 1 over I NL of KR into minus e to the I delta L plus e to the minus I delta L. And at this stage, I would actually like to take this minus sign inside here. And write it like that. So the final, and you see, I've done it again. I really keep leaving it out for some reason. 2L plus 1. Here? Why wouldn't it be this? Taking out this factor of e to the I delta L here. This is a plus. It's good that you asked me, but and so what do we get? JL of KR. This is just 2 cos delta L, so that combines with that 2 and just gets a cos delta L. And if I have done this right, this is 2i sine delta L. So the I goes with the I and gives me a minus sign. And I get a sine delta L. Which sort of shows how nicely the whole thing holds together. If you put delta L equal to 0, that is to say there is no scattering whatsoever, this will turn into a 1, that will turn into a 1, this will turn into a 0, and you get back to the original wave function that you know and love. So all of you can see that the effect of the scattering is just basically to introduce some mixture of the n's into your thing. That doesn't matter because although n is singular at the origin, this wave function doesn't work except at r greater than a. So the presence of n's there doesn't matter. So this kind of wave function holds everywhere outside some given region. Sorry?
For R greater than A.
Right.
Can we use the asymptotic forms to find for JL and
now? Like JL and
this works for all R greater than A. Because V is equal to 0 outside this given region. So it works everywhere down to this surface.
Why would you say that you take R going to
infinity? Yeah, compared the general formula with what I get from having R going to infinity. The general formula involves J's and N's and can't involve anything else. So I derive this by saying what no solution of Schrödinger's equation could possibly give rise to the asymptotic form that we have got. There's nothing else it could have done. So it's absolutely unique. It's tied down. So it is this. Not approximately this, it's exactly that. Exact form of the wave function. For R greater than A is uniquely determined by the asymptotic form as R goes to infinity. I only wrote it down because seem to be kind of necessary. So this works everywhere. You look very worried. The delta L's are still there. Look, here they are, cos delta L.
But they're still free.
They're free, they're determined by the nature of the problem that we wish to consider. By the potential. So here is a way of finding out what delta L is. If by some method you are able to determine the wave function inside this region, by any method you like, then all you have to do is to match up the wave function. So, for example, suppose that V of R was, I don't know, just a square well potential. Then you can find what the wave function is inside the potential and use it to determine the phase shifts. So, what would you do in practice? Psi for R less than A, let's call that psi minus, and let's call this guy psi plus so that we know which one is which. What's it going to be? It's probably going to be the sum from 0 to infinity of, let's write it like this, 2L plus 1 minus I to the L. And what can you have? You can't have any of this because this is singular at the origin. So whatever it is must be the form AL unknown coefficient times cos delta L. No, cos delta L. Times PL of cos theta. So now you can see we've got two unknowns. You've got cos delta L, the phase shift, and a whole set of coefficients inside this potential that you find from the Schrodinger equation. Of course, you don't know what these things are going to be. And we're missing a JL of KR. There's no guarantee that this K is the same as that K. It will depend on the form of the wave function, since these functions are complete. How do you find these coefficients? Too complicated. I mean, it will work, but it's too complicated. We've got two regions of space in which the wave function is known outside, we'll call it psi plus, and it's known inside, we'll call it psi minus. Psi minus we discover by doing something inside that particular potential. You know that the wave function must be continuous as you go from R greater than A to R less than A, that means wave function is continuous at R equals A. And its radial derivative must be continuous. So now you can do the calculation. At r equals a, you must make the whole things match up. So that says that whatever, since all the p's are linearly independent, you can just do each partial wave separately. And I fiddled this so that I got the same factor that was sitting here, 2l plus 1 minus I to the l, to make life easy. And so you get a series of equations that look like e to the I delta l, so this is continuity, e to the I delta l jl of ka cos delta l minus nl of ka sine delta l is equal to corresponding coefficient over here. That's all taken care of. PL is taken care of. And so I get AL JL of KA. Similarly, for the radial derivative, you just differentiate with respect to R and do the same thing. Somehow there just doesn't seem to be enough room on these boards. So what would you get? You get d by dr of this stuff. So I will end up with does everyone know what prime means? Prime. If I wrote down f of any function, it goes to f prime of x, meaning I differentiate with respect to its argument. You may think that this is a bit odd. So, what is f prime of kx? D of dkx, f of kx, which is 1 over k times d by dx of f of kx. So if I differentiate these Bessel function things with respect to r, I can write k times jl prime. So you're going to get e to the I delta L, a k into JL prime evaluated at KA times cos delta L minus NL prime of KA sine delta L is equal to, and then differentiate that one with respect to R for each partial wave, is equal to big K AL JL prime of KA. And those give you two equations for A and delta. So if you divide this one by this one, the A's cancel out and allow you to find delta. Now that process is sufficiently simple and mechanical that this gives you a lot of scope for setting problems on it. So I guess there aren't any more problems till Friday, which seems a little unfortunate. Thursday, problem tomorrow, isn't it TB test?
5. Okay, so we'll let you go to 3 on Thursday to go and do it again, that'd be good on Tuesday.
Takes 2 hours to get there.
Huh?
Takes 2 hours to get there.
No, they close at 5.
Right, so we'll show up at Court Street. They're not going to throw you out.
Yeah, so we'll see.
We've
got 3 o'clock.
You
probably have an hour's tutorial
still on Quantity. Yeah. Right. So that gives you a way of working these things out. You will notice that there is one thing where I said it's usually continuous. Of course, we all know an example where it's not, so first of all, it's not continuous, and that is potential is infinite. If the potential is infinite, then the boundary condition is the wave function just vanishes. So, as an example, I will do the easiest example, which is precisely that one. What do you have to do if you have an infinitely hard sphere that is doing the scattering? Well, what is the potential? Here, V is equal to 0. Here, V equals infinity. That means psi equals 0 inside here. And so the boundary condition that you need to impose at R equals A is not quite what I said. Well, it is exactly what I said. It's just putting all the A's equal to 0. In other words, the wave function psi minus is equal to 0. Which means that psi plus must be equal to 0 at R equals A. And that must be true for each partial wave, because all of these partial waves are independent. So it just means if you evaluate this stuff in square brackets at R equals A, you've got to get 0. So what you end up with is the following expression for delta L. So what you have to do is just make this 0. J L of K A cos delta L equals NL of KA sine delta L. So I can now write down a nice formula for the every single phase shift. Tan delta L is equal to JL of KA divided by NL of KA. So I found the phase shift. Which means I've solved that problem exactly. Unfortunately, as is often the case, an exact solution is not helpful, because this just involves nasty Bessel function mess, and you don't quite know what to do about it. So this is only really useful in various limiting cases. If you actually wanted to do something practical with this, you'd have to mess around with a computer, or a calculator, or a vast quantity of paper. Worth doing one very simple limiting case explicitly. Let's suppose that Ka was very small. Small k is small energy. What happens to these things? Well, you know the asymptotic form of these things near Ka equals 0. This one looks like ka to the power l. And this one looks like ka to the minus l, minus 1. So you can conclude immediately that all the phase shifts are small except for the very first one. So I'm only going to consider delta 0. Find delta 0. That's not hard, because you know what J0 of x is. J0 of x is equal to sine x over x. You know that N0 of x is minus cos x over x. So the quotient of the two, J0 of Ka divided by N0 of Ka, that's going to be tan of delta 0 something looks the wrong way up to me. I'm sure it shouldn't do. No, I'm sure that's right. Yes, is equal to minus tan of delta 0. Wait a minute, what have I done? What have I done? Minus tan of Ka, that's what I meant to have done. But Ka is small, so this approximates to delta 0 is approximately minus Ka, or Ka very much less than 1. And all the rest will be higher order. So delta L for L greater than or equal to 1 will be much smaller. You could work them all out if you like, but it's basically Ka to some huge power increasing with L. What then is a scattering cross-section? Sigma is equal to the sum from L equals 0 to infinity of sine squared delta L, a 4 pi over k squared, and that it, 2L plus 1. So in the approximation that you only have L equals 0, in the low energy approximation, delta L, well, is small, so sine squared delta L you can just replace by delta L squared. Sigma is 4 pi over k squared. 2L plus 1 is 1 for L equals 0. This is delta L squared, so that's k squared a squared. So you end up with 4 pi a squared. The scattering cross-section for an infinitely hard sphere is equal to 4 pi a squared for low energies. You might find that paradoxical if you think about the picture of what you mean by scattering cross-section. So here you have a sphere which is scattering something. Classically, an infinitely hard sphere is obviously going to have radius cross-section pi a squared. Because if this is a, you see any particle which is coming along inside this cylinder will bounce off the sphere somehow, but any particle outside this cylinder will not scatter. Inside the cylinder must scatter. So classically, sigma is going to be equal to pi a squared. If you think about what that means, it means that at high energies, that's what you'd expect. But at low energies, quantum mechanics tells you something quite different. At low energies, things behave differently, and you end up with a cross-section of 4 pi a squared and not pi a squared.
Larger area to track with?
Yes. I'm looking for a prop. I mean, classically, it's very simple. So if you took something that looks like this, and a particle comes this way, it impacts on this thing, then, or is scattered by it, then basically, what you're doing is you're saying this area that the particle sees and will be scattered. So it's sort of really a geometrical area. Classically, it's kind of obvious what it means. You go this way, you hit it, you bounce off, that's scattering. And classically, it has this area, which is equal to just pi a squared, which will be the circle. What you see quantum mechanically is that even though this is an infinitely hard object, so that everything bounces off it, classically at any rate, quantum mechanically it's sort of replaced by a fuzz that is bigger. And so you don't actually have to hit the target, so to speak. Being close to it is good enough. Well, that's kind of what you'd expect from quantum mechanics. If you know that the thing is going close to it, you know that there's uncertainty in position, and so you'd expect to be able to feel this object even though you're not there. That's what happens. Because it's really a wave rather than a particle. And so, from the wave point of view, say the thing was diffracting around this object. So that's how you calculate cross-sections for scattering off localized regions. So now I want to tell you a little bit about what you observe in practice if you do this. So you can, of course, observe all kinds of things that look like this. But there's one phenomenon which is, I suppose, extraordinary, and is also related to this business of functions not behaving exactly as you'd expect. And that is the phenomenon of resonance. So let me give you a fictional account of this first, because it is easier. In high-energy physics scattering experiments, you often see a picture that looks like this. You measure the scattering cross-section as a function of energy, and you discover that you end up with a bump that looks something like that. I guess it was actually discovered in nuclear physics experiments, really, rather than high energy. So you're asked to try and describe this phenomenon by using phase shifts. After all, phase shifts are the only tool that you've got, theoretically, because they work whatever the potential is. So you measure something which looks like this. What conclusion would you come to? This is associated with a rapid change in phase shift. I do not know who is responsible for figuring that out. I suspect it is Wigner, but I'm not certain. So rather than go from this to find a rapid change of phase shift, what we will do is invent a rapid change of phase shift and then see if it reproduces something like that. It's always much easier to do it that way around. So what kind of thing would you expect? Well, here is a picture of delta L and drawn as a function of energy. And the kind of thing that I want to consider will be going from a phase shift of n pi, think about it, at n pi nothing much happens, to n plus 1 pi. Let's suppose that happens at some energy scale E naught. So what will the picture of the phase shift look like? Well, it will just sort of go along here for a little bit, and then it will suddenly start to jump that looks something like that. So that's, it's not supposed to go up here. Maybe helpful to make it look a bit smoother. Of course, the more I try, the worse it will get. So how would you model that? Well, the answer is you'd say, well, delta L has to look like a function which changes. Those will be delta 0, something. And then the easiest thing to do is to think of some function which goes from minus pi over 2 to plus pi over 2. Such a thing is the inverse tan function. So as e goes to minus something large compared to e0, this is going to minus infinity, so this thing is minus pi by 2. That seems to be the wrong way around. So as e goes off to here somewhere, this function goes to minus pi by 2. For e very much bigger than e0. What am I talking about? I have become confused. Apologies. Let's start again. If e goes to minus infinity, this thing is going to 0. If e goes to e0, this thing has got a pole in it, so this is going to infinity, and you would probably say that this thing was tending to pi by 2. And then as e becomes huge compared to e0, it goes to pi. 2 puzzled people.
Yes. I might be misremembering this. Wasn't there some sort of thing that says that the scattering cross section had a decrease in the function of energy?
Yes, but that was only really, there was a bound, it couldn't go above.
Okay, so it doesn't have to be strictly decreasing.
So it doesn't have to be strictly decreasing.
So the bound is an asymptotic bound, right? It has to be a one over.
Right, because it had to be, sine squared had to be less than one.
Yeah.
But you often don't obtain anything near the bound. That's just an absolute upper bound, not positively configured.
Well,
the bound is likely to be sort of way up. It's, I mean, this might be quite close to the bound in practice. But it doesn't have to saturate the bound.
Wait, so this isn't an asymptotic bound? This is
an absolute bound. Sigma must be less than. For each partial wave, it must be less than 4 pi over k squared, sine squared, well, the umbrella is 1, so you're going to 12 plus 1. So you have to do that for each partial wave. And of course, no one is telling you where this maximum is. We're all happy about that. So this will be some constant corresponding to something like that. So what will...
Nothing to do with the lowest order harmonic then.
Sorry?
Normally, you've got delta L, so L equals to zero.
It could be any partial wave. It is usually L equals zero, but not always.
The delta L constant, delta zero constant's a bit confusing then.
All right, we'll change it.
Sorry.
Right. Make life easy. Just suppose it's that and that alone. So suppose the phase shift is given by that expression. What is the cross section for that particular partial wave? I'm a bit confused by something that I wrote. So all we have to do is to find out what sine delta L is. Yes. These constants, gamma, big gamma, two. And E0 is a sort of value of energy where the phase shift takes place. So we've got a situation that looks like that. We need to calculate sine delta L. Actually, we need to calculate sine squared delta L. And if you think about it, that must be, well, if tan delta L is gamma over 2 E0 minus E, sine squared delta L over 1 minus sine squared delta L is gamma squared over 4, divided by E0 minus E, all squared. And therefore, sine squared delta L is going to be it's gamma into E0 minus E, all squared, is gamma squared over 4, minus gamma squared over 4, sine squared delta L.
So sine squared delta L is gamma squared over 4 into E0 minus E all squared plus gamma squared over 4. So that partial wave, the scattering cross-section, will look something like 4 pi over k squared, 2L plus 1, sine squared delta L, gamma squared over 4, E0 minus E, all squared plus gamma squared over 4. And k squared is probably the same thing as E, essentially. So I could replace this by 2ME. So that's the formulas I get. What does that look like? Exactly as promised. If I drew a picture of this, sigma L, as a function of energy, then it looks something like that. It will have a bump. Arctan. E is going to minus infinity. So it's going to 0. Right. I've written E is very much less than E0, goes to 0.
That E is much
greater than E0, so E is Q. Oh, you say I've got a sign problem. You said it's the wrong way up. It's a multi-valued function. Right. Yeah, so I think, remember that as you go from minus infinity to plus infinity, so you want to go from 0 to 0. So you start off at 0. You want it to be monotonic, so that means that it goes to pi. That's the next place is a 0. And it's pi by 2 in the middle. So I think I believe what I said. You see, that's what I got confused about to start with. I wrote this down, and then I suddenly thought, well, is that really quite right? The answer is yes, it is right. If this thing goes to minus infinity, this thing is going to 0. Where is the next 0? It's at pi. Halfway between where there's a pole is pi by 2. Remember that tan is a multi-valued function. But whether that's precisely right or not doesn't matter. The point is that the peak is at E0, and you will discover that if that is gamma, then approximately, if that's sigma max, this is sigma max over 2. So gamma is usually called the width. So this kind of behavior, where you get a curve that looks like this, is known as a Bright-Figner form. Now, let's look at the S objects. I've got time to do this. E to the 2i delta L is sometimes called the S matrix. And we can just simply substitute in and find out what this thing is. And without making a huge fuss about it, let's just write down the answer. It's E minus E0. Minus I gamma over 2, E plus, even minus E0 plus I gamma over 2. So that's the function that you get with this particular form. So what you will see is that this phenomenon here, usually called a resonance, is associated with a pole in the S matrix. At E equals E0 minus I gamma over 2. Now, it'll be kind of qualitative about this, but this is of quite considerable significance. That's because you already know about poles in the S matrix, although you don't know you know about poles in the S matrix. Well, very qualitatively, what we have done so far is to calculate wave functions of the form e to the ikr over r plus be to the minus ikr over r, roughly. And the thing that we called the S matrix, the phase shift, e to the 2i delta l, is roughly speaking, therefore, I must make sure I get this right way up, otherwise it all goes terribly wrong. It's the outgoing amplitude divided by the ingoing amplitude. Which, not scattered, outgoing amplitude, all of it, is equal to B over A. Is equal to A over B. I have to get it the right way up. But this thing will be a function of, effectively, energy. Now, how do you recognize a bound state? If this was an honest wave function, A and B would be functions of energy. And you would recognize a bound state by saying that the wave function dies off at infinity. and the energy must be less than zero. So those are the symptoms of a bound state given any wave function. Now there's a question somewhere. So that's a mistake. Well, it doesn't matter whether it does or it doesn't, actually, for these purposes. They both should have them. So that's how you'd recognize a bound state. I mean, it basically says that the wave function has got to be square integrable and so forth, and the energy has got to be negative. But in the language we're using over here, this corresponds to k being imaginary. Now, if you don't believe me, put k equal to I times kappa. What would happen to this wave function? It would go to something like 1 over I kappa r, a, which is now a function. Well, it's still a function of k, so it'll be I kappa. E to the minus kappa r plus b of I kappa into e to the plus kappa r. So a bound state would correspond to putting b equal to zero. Remember that a and b are fixed by whatever you're actually trying to calculate. Namely, the wave function does not blow up at infinity. But if B is zero, then there is a pole in the S matrix. So that if you drew a picture of the complex k-plane, k being the wave number, then the S-matrix will have singularities along the positive real axis, poles, corresponding to the bound states. And if you wanted to know the energy of those poles, well, it would be wherever h, take the value of k complex, and that would give you the energy. So what have we found? We have found poles in the lower half plane corresponding to resonances. Well, if there were any resonances, that's what we'd have found. What is their physical significance? Well,
the wild energy levels in the bound states.
Wild energy levels in the bound states, absolutely right. How would you see that? Well, what you would do would be to solve the Schrödinger equation. And you would say the time dependence was e to the I e energy divided by h bar and a factor of minus. So what happens if you have a bound state? Well, you just put E equal to minus h bar squared k squared over 2m. What happens if you find a resonance? What is the energy at these things? We already know that poles in the S matrix occur precisely there. Oh, sorry, E to the... So if you ask, how would they evolve in time, you would stick this into that expression. So their time evolution looks like E to the I E0 minus I gamma minus I E0 minus I gamma over 2 T over H bar. So it looks like a state of energy E0 . So it's conventional time evolution with energy E0. And then there will be a factor of E to the minus gamma T over 2 H bar outside the whole thing. So in other words, that state would die off in time rapidly at a rate controlled by gamma. So you infer that a resonance is interpreted as a metastable bound state energy equal to E0, which is positive, but has a time decay given by gamma. And if you think about it, that's actually the half width, because you need to square the wave function to get an amplitude. So it decays on a time scale h bar over gamma. Yes?
Because if you set k imaginary, you have a cross section which is negative.
Is it physical? Yes and no. No, from the point of view of Maslow's complicated. Well, maybe partially. But yes, definitely from the point of view of relativistic quantum mechanics. Because what you usually think of as being virtual processes probe all possible values of k. So that, for example, when you calculate the propagator of the quantum field, you have to investigate its behavior for all values of k and not just k real. So the answer to that is yes or no, depending on your point of view. So I guess if you're a condensed matter physicist, you wouldn't bother too much. But if you do something relativistic, it is absolutely vital that you consider all possible values of k. So I suppose at this level, looking at complex k is a mathematical artifice. However, it is still a fact that if you look at the singularities of the S matrix, you assume that the S matrix has other properties which I have not described, namely things like unitarity and obeying various kinds of causality relations, then you can prove that it has to have a particular analytic form, and you would deduce the existence of poles in the S matrix independently of other things,
under certain circumstances. So it's sort of one of these peculiar things, is that you start off by thinking it's not very physical, and then you end up by realizing it's actually really quite important. Is K imaginary physical? Well, possibly yes, because if you ask yourself, does this actually happen in practice? The answer is yes. You do see resonances. And resonances do give rise to metastable states. And that's, I mean, how you detect anything which has fleeting existence inside some system. So in that sense, K-complex is a sort of real physical thing. Take another example. What about the wave function for a neutron? Does that have real K? I think my answer to that would be no. Because the neutron is an unstable particle and decays with a lifetime of 900 and whatever it is seconds. So I would say the fact that I can measure that lifetime means that its K is not real. It's true that it's almost stable, so K squared is almost real, but perhaps not quite. So actually I've argued myself into saying that K complex is physical.
Yeah, but for the second part, if you take imaginary physical, then we have an expression for cross-section, which is a negative value. How do we interpret that one now?
Negative value of K?
That's a negative value of sigma, the cross-section, which is supposed to be something that we can actually measure.
Oh, K squared, you can only measure cross-sections for waves which are going somewhere. You can't measure a cross-section for bound states. There's only bound states that K squared is negative. You can't do that. Remember, what you're doing is the experiment consists of firing things into something. That tells you you can only measure it for K squared positive. You don't continue the cross-section. That doesn't mean anything. You continue amplitudes, like the S matrix or the phase shift. You can't continue a physical thing like cross-section. Yes.
Well, I'm a little confused at what it is you're calling the S matrix. Because you put up e to the I delta L.
Just said.
Yeah, but how is that a matrix? There's only one index.
It's absolutely true here. Wait till you come across Dr. Tom next week.
Oh, so the other index has to do with...
You will discover this is a one-by-one matrix, the way I've written it. But actually, you could say, well, maybe you... You could argue this was actually an infinite by infinite matrix. But diagonal, long L. So it's true, it's this for each partial wave. But I said there's one of these for each value of L, if you like. That would turn into a matrix, although a diagonal one. He will tell you much more about the S matrix than I will, or at least he never had to.
Nima talked a lot about the S matrix. That was.
Oh, is that what's causing the problem? I'll rephrase that.
This is like the beginning of that story.
Yeah.
Let me just define the S matrix for you, so this is my definition of the S matrix, it might not be his. Suppose you start off in some initial state, I, and you want to end up in some final state, F. So implicitly, this will be at t equals plus infinity. This is at t equals minus infinity, then this is what I call the S matrix, with components S, F, I. There are some people in the world who define things the other way around, so that for them it would be S dagger. But for me, that's what it is. And that really is a matrix. If you like, this is the same thing as specifying the time evolution operator from plus infinity to minus infinity, and that is undoubtedly what David Tong will call it. But this is the same thing as a phase shift, because if you think about this thing, it's this thing that relates the ingoing to the outgoing states. So it's all the same thing, although it may have different names and be written differently under different circumstances. I guess what is kind of confusing is that there is a, it's used interchangeably to describe the matrix elements or the operators, which is not good, but a fact of life. You have a question?
As I understand it, so if I want to do a scattering, some scattering problem, and I know the S operator, I just, like, if I have, if I know the S operator in the basis of these, like, combined with the cell and Lagrange equations,
yeah.
I just expand, so I expand my incoming wave in that basis, and then I just act on it with the operator that's e to the, you know, that multiplies each L, the L component by
right.
either the 2i delta L, and I have the open wave.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's it. It's as simple as that. Okay, well, I think that's all I wanted to say about the S matrix and scattering amplitudes. So tomorrow we'll move on to things which are relativistic. So let's stop there for today.